and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, former Labor Commissioner Ed Flanagan and UAA economist Kyle Hampton. Alaska voters have the opportunity to say yes or no on a higher minimum wage this November. Ballot Measure 3 would raise the state's minimum wage from $7.75 per hour to $9.75 over the next 2 years, and then adjust the minimum wage for inflation each year after 2016. This debate was hosted by Alaska Common Ground. It was recorded July 30th at the Wilda Marston Theater. Former Alaska Common Ground board member Taylor Brelsford moderated this debate. This talk was edited for broadcast, but you can find the full debate on our website at alaskapublic.org. And you can also find the PowerPoint presentations from each presenter on our website in case you want to follow along. Here we go.
Thank you very much, Cliff, and thanks to all of you who've joined us on a brilliant sunny evening. Our panelists are both distinguished, knowledgeable people who will offer us a good deal of information. Ed Flanagan, on your right, has a career in public service as a former commissioner of labor and workforce development under Governor Tony Knowles. He has a historic connection to this issue, having led the administration's efforts on legislation instituting the last increase in minimum wage in 2002. He has a long time history with the labor movement. And finally, he is one of the initiative sponsors, one of the organizers for the initiative to increase the minimum wage. Help me welcome Ed Flanagan, please. And now with us to discuss the opposing point of view to the initiative is Dr. Kyle Hampton, an assistant professor of economics at the University of Alaska and director of the UAA Center for Economic Education. His academic work includes some innovative areas in economics. You'll see details in the program. And it's also worth noting that he's been recognized and is an exceptional teacher and one of the young talents in Alaska, one of Alaska's top 40 under 40. So Kyle, thank you for joining us. Please welcome Kyle Hampton as well. On format, we will start with opening presentations from the two presenters. First, in favor of the initiative, Ed Flanagan, followed by a position opposing the initiative, and that will be from Kyle Hampton. Following the presentations, there will be a few minutes for direct exchange between the panelists, follow-up questions of one another, and then we will turn to questions from the audience. So with that, I think we're ready to turn to Ed Flanagan for the presentation in favor of the initiative to raise the minimum wage.
Thank you, Taylor. And I'd like to thank Alaska Common Ground and all the sponsors. I'd name them, but I'm on a time restraint here. I really appreciate not only this forum, but the series of forums. It's a great service as we approach the both elections. I'd also like to thank Professor Hampton for providing an opposing view. To date, we don't have, at least that I'm aware of yet, a declared, registered opposition opposing group. Wouldn't be surprised if one arises, but wouldn't want to be here debating myself, or at least, well, I might think different when this is done, but glad to have him here representing an opposing view. And I'd like to thank all of you for coming. I know this isn't quite like last week's, but for as nice as the weather is out there, this is a very impressive turnout. So thank you for coming. I guess to get right into it, why increase the minimum wage and why do it now? Well, Alaska's minimum wage as of coming January 1 will not have been increased in 5 years. And at that point it was $7.75, which then was an inadequate minimum wage. We got to differentiate between a minimum wage and a truly living wage, which is usually done on a local area concept. You know, I've heard of Seattle. I hear a lot of talk about the $15. But for a statewide minimum wage, Alaska certainly has to have something that would provide for a better level of support for folks. Now, Some quick history. I got to go quick because I tend to get bogged down in that, an old history major. But 1959, Alaska became, in the first legislature, the first state to enact its own minimum wage higher than the federal. First, right out of the chute, 1959 legislature. Federal minimum wage was a buck. Alaska legislature said Alaska's a buck 50. And given the even then higher, much higher relative cost of living, it made a lot of sense. And it still did. And that kept Alaska at the top among the states for over 30 years and close to the top in the top three through the last century. When the federal minimum wage, which for a long time had been periodically two or three times a decade adjusted, kind of stopped being a bipartisan effort. There were no raises through the whole Reagan presidency, 9 years. It really started to lose ground. More states addressed this with their own minimum wages. Washington and Oregon were the first to put a CPI or a cost of living adjustment on it. And Alaska, you know, there's enough interest in following suit. There was an attempted initiative that fell short. And then in 2001, Governor Knowles introduced a bill to increase the minimum wage from $5.65 to $7.15. The House Speaker at the time introduced a bill which ended up being the vehicle. Bill stalled. There was an initiative by the AFL-CIO that did not fail, got 50,000 signatures in about 3 months. And with that impetus, the legislature suddenly was interested in acting. And the bill passed nearly unanimously, about six no votes in the House and one no vote in the Senate. And Alaska's minimum wage was set then to go January 1, 2003, basically overnight. It had initially been a two-phase, like ours is, a two-year phase-in to allow businesses time to adjust, not have a shock to the system. But at that point, because the year had been lost, it was all in one shot, 27% increase overnight to January 1, 2003. The bill also called for, as passed, a cost of living adjustment to geared to the Anchorage CPI, Consumer Price Index, or on that annual adjustment, if the federal had gone up, it would always be at least a dollar over the federal. Well, unfortunately, the legislature came back the next year, and I'm usually not accused of not being cynical enough when it comes to the actions of the legislature. They came back less than a year later and repealed the CPI and the COLA and the federal provision, basically gutting the bill. And really for 7 years, 6 years later, after that, 6.5 years, the minimum wage was frozen at $7.15. We continued to lose ground. We don't have to be the highest in the country, but we ought to be close to it. By 2009, we were about to be eclipsed by the federal minimum wage. It was going up to 7.25. So some legislators tried, and the Senate tried to get a $8.75 minimum wage, which is where it would have been if they hadn't reduced the CPI and repealed it in 2003. And then a CPI, and all they were able to get was a restoration of the 50 cents over federal. They put a 10-cent increase in to match the federal. July, 5 years ago last week, was the last federal increase to 7.25. And then on January 1st, 2010, the 50 cents over federal was restored. Of course, that premium now represents only 7% of the federal minimum wage. 1959, it was 50%. So next January 1st, if we don't act on this initiative, it will be 5 years since there's been an increase in the minimum wage. Now, last year around March, myself and two other former state labor commissioners, Jim Sampson of Fairbanks, Tom Cashin of Juneau, we'd grumbled for, I guess, 10 years about when was somebody going to fix this, and finally realized that we were, you know, two out of three of us were retired, and we ought to just go ahead and do it ourselves. So we formed the, you know, ad hoc ballot group under the state provision, the state law for initiatives, Alaskans for a Fair Minimum Wage. We obviously didn't stay up all night thinking up the name, but that kind of said what we were looking to do. And we went through the hoops you do to get certified for the ballot through the Lieutenant Governor's office. And we had 150 volunteers collecting throughout the state. And we had significant funding from Alaska's labor unions, the vast majority of which don't represent workers in an industry that's even close to the minimum wage. They really support this as a public service and should be commended for it. And we were able to hire a contractor, like most successful efforts have done, to use paid signature gatherers in Anchorage. And over the course of about 8 months, we got 43,500 signatures. Now, we had great response. All three sponsors collected signatures. And that was part of the plan, you know, how to, you know, really get a good feel for what people thought about this issue to prepare for the campaign and to inform ourselves. You know, we had to put something out there. You agonize over what amount to put out there. But what we settled on doing was really taking the $7.15 that had been instituted in 2003 and pretty much acting as if the law had not been thwarted by the 2003 legislature, and came up to right about where we would have been. It would be $9.53 today an hour. We'd still be the highest in the country, 21 cents over Seattle's $9.32, had the legislature left well enough alone in 2003. As it turned out, they weren't willing to, or at least some of them weren't willing to leave well enough alone this year and tried to preempt us again with a bill, and we could not be blamed for expecting the same result as we had last 9 years ago, 10 years ago, and Alaskans let the legislature know that they wanted a chance to vote on this, and we will have the chance to vote on it. Not in August, as was originally planned because of the overrun of the legislature, but in November. Like I said, we had great response. I collected signatures in some of, you know, what are generally recognized as some of the more conservative areas of the state. And when we talk about common ground, this is a neat issue because Alaskans, and especially in Juneau, we can't find an issue down there that we can't disagree on 51-49 percentage-wise. But on this one, had really good response. People were very interested, very enthusiastic, had a lot of people telling us we weren't going high enough, which kind of gave me some drafter's remorse that maybe we should have gone for 10 or 10-15. But we had a lot of, Matt Sue, Ketchikan. Ketchikan folks came up. They knew who paid minimum wage in town and let you know it and that they didn't think it was right. Had a lot of small business people come up, sign the petition, and say, heck yeah, I'm a small business, I got two or three employees, but I can't, in good conscience, pay less than 10 bucks an hour. And that was real informative. We'll be getting some ads, digital ads. We're not going to run much mainstream media with these folks in front of their businesses. And in Sitka, not talking about conservative places there, Sitka, for an example, I had in the same afternoon, I'm standing out in front of the post office. You know, you wear a sign. It was a Martian green was the printer's color for the paper, minimum wage petition, kind of looked like a rodeo clown. But folks would come up and, you know, they knew what you were doing, and they could walk around you if they didn't want to sign it. But in the same afternoon, I had two gallery owners, a lot of art galleries in Sitka. And they're open, well, this was before Christmas, but I think a lot of them are open year-round. Came up and said basically the same thing. Yeah, I got a gallery, and you know, I pay my people at least 10 bucks to start. In this town, it'd be crazy to pay them less. That same afternoon, I had a worker from a third gallery who said, yeah, I want to see this raised. I'm working for that gallery over there. I make $7.75 an hour. Well, what does this say? Here's two high road employers, relatively high road employers, that are suffering a competitive disadvantage from an employer right in the same block, selling the same type of materials, who avails themselves of the absolute minimum they have to pay under the law. I mean, there is business support for this. Even, we'll get to opponents in a little bit, but, you know, when you poll business groups that, you know, might even end up being the opposing view for the ballot pamphlets and things like that, 33% of their members will support this initiative. That happened historically, and it's showed up in one survey already of a business group that is generally opposed to this. Now, I said, Alaska doesn't have to be number one, but we sure as heck shouldn't be number 19. Here's where we stack up compared to the rest of the states and the District of Columbia right now. And look at that list, Arizona and Florida. Those are low-wage states where it's a heck of a lot cheaper to live than Alaska, and they've got a higher minimum wage than us. And because they've got a CPI adjustment, they're gonna be higher still on January 1st. This shows us 19th as of September 1st. Michigan hasn't gone on to 8.15 yet. California just went to 9. But if we don't pass the initiative, we'll be 21st place. We'll be behind West Virginia. This is patently absurd. And this was a real selling point with people when they saw this. Now, I got to admit, I had people come up, are you trying to raise it to $15? I said, no, that's Seattle, sir. That's a different concept. We're trying to raise 9.75. Okay, they weren't happy with 15. I wouldn't propose a $15 minimum wage. It might piss some people off, but that are advocates. But at some point, the arguments that I can pretty much dismiss out of hand about job losses at a modest level like we're proposing, at some level, I don't know where, but at 15, they might actually have some truth to them, and I can't just, you know, rebut them with the studies that we have. It'll be interesting to see what happens after Seattle. That'll be a real proving ground for other efforts, and maybe someday we need to have some local living wage ordinances in Alaska. But for the minimum wage, this proposal, will put us, we won't be the top, but if we go to 9.75 and if the legislature leaves us alone, we get our CPI increases, we'll be amongst the top of the states, and that is more appropriate. We are the fourth, we're not the most expensive state anymore. That's good. We're the fourth most expensive state. But anyway, polls reflect strong support. 69% in the poll that the legislature did. A majority of all political parties, even a majority of Republicans, 52%, I think, in the Dittman poll that the legislature did. We've had really good support. You'll be seeing, starting probably around Labor Day, you know, we'll be announcing resolutions of support and sign on from a significant element of the faith community, from various community organizations, of course, the unions. We're building the Alaska Needs a Raise Coalition, and we welcome inquiry solicitation from or anybody who would be interested in joining. Now, it's a great proposal. What's not to like? I mean, who could have a problem with the minimum wage? But you never know. I mean, it takes all kinds. And we do have some groups that traditionally oppose it. In the past, it has been seafood processors. And, you know, it's their industry groups. They don't like government telling them what to do. I think I can understand that. But still, as a society, especially one that underwrites their low wages by subsidizing their employees. I mean, not picking on Walmart. Walmart in this state is not like in other states. They pay probably, I think based on my experience with family members working for them and for other box stores, they started about a buck over what we're even proposing to raise it to. That wouldn't be the case if we were in other states. But Walmart, $6.2 billion that taxpayers pay so their employees can subsist on the wages they pay elsewhere. Fast food industry, $7 billion. I mean, this is a common sense approach to 2 minutes. Okay, here we go. I got to start talking like a New Yorker, folks, and get as much in as I can in the next 2 minutes. Now, conservative economists traditionally oppose it. You know, it's basic theory that if you raise the, you know, they cite that if you raise the cost of something, the demand is going to go down, and that includes labor. And of course, that's in a perfectly competitive market, but for a long time, the argument was mostly theoretical. They also say, you know, inflation is going to be a problem. Well, Goldman Sachs just analyzed, you know, not exactly a tool of the working class. Goldman Sachs just analyzed the federal $10.10 proposal and projected that the inflation effect would be probably something like 0.1%. But it's in the last 20 years, there have been empirical studies. Two guys, Card and Kruger, Kruger just stepped down as chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. They said, hey, we've been doing this every 5 years at least since 1938. Did any of the stuff that they always say is going to happen happen? And they looked at, and there's been many studies now challenging that, replicating it, you know, trying different spins on it. But they looked at two adjoining counties in different states. Jersey had raised it, their rate, Pennsylvania, in an area where it was a bi-state metropolitan area. What happened? And they surveyed a large number of fast food restaurants and found that actually, some people referred to it as the hamburger flipper study. The employment went up in the fast food restaurants in the area where the wages had gone up. Because guess what? Low-wage people had more money to maybe go out once a week and buy a burger. There's been a whole lot of, I mean, it's almost an arms race in studies. There's a letter was sent to Congress supporting the federal proposal with signed by 600 PhD economists, including 7 Nobel laureates. 500 economists then signed a letter put together by National Restaurant Association. I mean, we can let them duke it out at the national level. In Alaska, here's what we've got. Here's what happened. We have real-world experience. 2002 to 2003, total non-ag employment, that is all jobs, not uniform military, and not fishers, not self-employed. Monthly employment up. This is like a 27% increase overnight. And in the following year, both up. Employment. Private sector employment, about the same numbers. But here's, look at these low-wage industries. Identified the Department of Labor as the four main low-wage industries that employ low-wage, minimum wage, or low-wage workers. Seafood production, 5.9%. Other factors operant here, no doubt. 8.1% increase in wages. Retail trade, up. Accommodations, that's hotels. Food services and drinking, predictions of dire consequences if this bill passed without a so-called tip credit that lets restaurants pay less to their servers. 4.3% increase in wages. That's thousands of Alaskan workers able to have a better way of life because of a basic protection Ed, provided by government.
Ed, let me ask you to conclude there.
Okay.
We will have some additional exchanges, so I think we will have an opportunity for you to insert some additional points. Thanks very much. Obviously, a passionate historic review of how this issue has unfolded in Alaska. I think what we'd like to do now is to turn to Professor Kyle Hampton. There we are.
All right, so the poll numbers typically are about 75% to 85% in favor of raising the minimum wage in the United States at any given time. So at least I hope you will give me some points for degree of difficulty.
Fair enough.
So when I was growing up, what drove me into economics were two questions that were raised in my mind. One was raised when I visited Washington, D.C., and I saw that money was printed in a machine. And I immediately thought to myself, well, why the hell don't we have another machine? That would be an obvious way to solve this problem. And the second question that occurred to me was more of a micro question. When I found out that there was this thing they call the minimum wage, I said, why isn't it $100? The reason why, that joke died horribly. The reason why I have this picture, you might not be able to tell what this is. This is a seawall in Hawaii. And when I teach economics, one of the things that I like to focus on is the ecological nature of markets and the ecological nature of prices. In Hawaii, people would get upset when the ocean would come up so far that it would actually break over the beach and into their yards and kill their grass. And so their solution to that was to build walls, still allowing themselves some amount of beach, but a wall so that when the sea really came up, it did not manage to get into the grass. The result of this was that when the ocean did come up to the wall, it's not like the ocean got to the wall and said, oh darn, I'm going back into the ocean. There was a force there, and that force, simply by putting up a wall, was not dissipated. In fact, what happened was it was driven downward, and it scours all the sand out, so the nice beach that you used to have is now gone. And I think this is an apt metaphor for these sorts of policies. This idea that if we're uncomfortable with a particular price, in this case, if we're uncomfortable with the fact that wages are too low. And let me make perfectly clear, especially for low-skilled and blue-collar workers in this country and in this state right now, we are going through a crisis of extremely low wages. On that, we can definitely find common ground, absolutely. However, the idea that you can simply solve this problem by passing a law that says that employers have to pay more and that there's not some sort of ramification, not some sort of reaction to this is folly. Good intentions aren't good enough. In fact, when you put up a wall like a price control, or in this case a price floor, this minimum wage, the same forces that would have given you that low wage are still there. They're just going to manifest themselves in different ways. Okay, so everybody has been out dip netting, I assume. So I wanted to do a real quick experiment because I do experiments actually in the classroom a lot. What I want to know is, for $5, how many of you would be willing to clean the fish that someone else had caught for them? If you could raise your hand. For $5 per fish. Yeah, okay, so, all right, how many of you would clean fish for $5? Nope. Sir, you said yes to both. Yeah. All right, okay. All right, how about then $8? How many of you would be willing to clean a fish for $8 for your neighbor?
One single fish?
A single fish, and you can do as many as you like, okay? And how many of you would pay $8 to have that fish cleaned? Okay, all right, so what we see here are two different prices, two different wages. In one case, we have an imbalance where we had more people willing to clean the fish than we had people willing to hire them to do so. And in the other case, we had the opposite situation. So let me show you what happens here. You've got a wage of $10. And at that wage of $10, in this example, you can see that there are 8 employers who are willing to hire at that wage. And you can see over here the employees, I don't know, it's a lot of them, okay? Now what I'm gonna do is, the way prices actually emerge is when this imbalance takes place. When you have more employees than you have employers, then you expect there to be downward pressure on the wage. The reason why is because some of these employees know that they're not going to get any job if they're not willing to do so for less. And so this pushes down wages. So currently that imbalance is going to drive the wage down. And you can see that as the wage goes down to 9, we get a few more employers. We get a few fewer employees. As the wage goes down further at $8, we now have an equal number. If we overshoot, we get more employers than we have employees. If we overshoot further, the same imbalance occurs. And the idea here is, and trust me, I would give anything to be able to do supply and demand in 15 minutes, but I can't do it. What I'm trying to demonstrate is that the price is not some sort of, it's not a moral decision that is being made by society. It is, in fact, very simply the price, the wage, that balances the number of jobs with the number of workers. If you choose to have a wage, if you mandate a wage that is too high, then you're going to get that imbalance. You're going to have more people trying to get those high-paying jobs than you actually have jobs, and the result there is unemployment. The first federal minimum wage was enacted in 1938, and it was about 25 cents. The U.S. Department of Labor later found that it resulted in an immediate job loss of between 30,000 and 50,000. However, Puerto Rico suffered the worst. Because their natural wage was actually around 4 cents to 5 cents per hour, the increase of the minimum wage to 25 cents actually resulted in job losses of 120,000 and an unemployment rate of 50%. I'm not bringing this up to suggest that this is what would happen in Alaska, merely to assert that this is not all dry theory, that this is in fact something that really happens, and that if you do push the minimum wage high enough, you will see these sorts of unemployment effects result. In fact, just recently, President Obama signed emergency legislation to postpone a minimum wage increase in American Samoa after the governor, after the governor begged for it, essentially. We are watching our economy burn down. We do not know what to do to stop it. We need to bring the aggressive wage cost decreed by the federal government under control. Our job market is being torched, et cetera. The point is that President Obama did recognize that these increases in the minimum wage do have these effects on unemployment and acted to stop that minimum wage increase in American Samoa just recently. 1982, now there's, as Ed referred, there's lots and lots of folks on both sides of the aisle having this fight. He mentioned Cardin Kruger, and I'll come back to that shortly. Certainly Newmark and Washer are the other side of this debate. But there's been lots of different, not just analyses, but meta-analyses. Folks who have actually gone through and not run their own study, but actually looked at older studies and tried to get some sort of idea of the overarching theme. In 1982, the Minimum Wage Study Commission found that a 10% increase in the minimum wage reduces teenage employment by 1 to 3%. This is not theoretical. This was data-driven. In 2006, Newmark and Washer looked at over 100 studies, 85% of which showed disemployment effect for low-skilled workers. In 2011, Biscaya and Rubenstein found that the minimum wage has notable wage impacts and a large corresponding disemployment effects. They looked at lots and lots of different studies. And in 2014, just recently here in February, the Congressional Budget Office, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, came out and announced that an increase in the minimum wage to what is being proposed, $10.10, would result in the loss of 500,000 jobs. There's also been very little research on Alaska specifically, but a new working paper that's out right now from Hansen and Hawley demonstrate that a couple of facts about Alaska. One is that the number of workers affected by the proposed minimum wage increase, and this would be folks who are earning between the current minimum wage here and the new proposed federal standard, would be about 25,000 folks, which is about 8% to 9% of the workforce. So it actually would have a smaller effect here in Alaska than it's going to have in the rest of the country. The predicted job losses in this paper for Alaska, and I apologize for this range, but I think they were trying to be as fair as possible to all the possible assumptions, 1.2% to 13%. Now, if you extrapolate that out, if we do pass the $10.10 federal minimum wage, and the ballot measure passes up here, we would have an $11.10 minimum wage. You can extrapolate out from their data, and it would show that you're looking at job losses between 1.6% and 17% here in Alaska. And I will stress that it's not just job losses that you should worry about, but a lot of folks have really stressed the fact that it's the lack of job creation. So you may not see direct unemployment, but you will see a lack of jobs being created. Now, Card and Kruger were mentioned, and how did I know that Card and Kruger would be mentioned and made slides for it? Because basically it's famous, because it's an incredibly contrarian paper that says, went it up against basically what the literature had been saying for almost 50 years. Card and Kruger found that in one particular instance, that an increase in the minimum wage did not result in an increase in unemployment. they found that the increase in the minimum wage increased employment. Now, Alan Kruger became chairman of the White House Council on Economic Advisers in 2011, and so you would say, oh, wow, fantastic, he must really know his stuff, but I see the causality actually being backwards here. I dare say that Alan Kruger was a popular pick in large part because of the work that he had done in justifying the minimum wage. In 2010, Newmark and Washer actually went back and looked at all the data. Instead of looking at what Card and Kruger had looked at, which were just surveys of business owners, they actually went back and looked at payroll stubs and found that, in fact, the actual job losses amounted to 4% after that increase. Now, the battle between Card and Kruger, as Ed mentioned, is ongoing, but it really doesn't matter because the thing is, all of these studies, in order to really get at the effects, all of these studies have to look at short-term effects because the longer term you look, the more other factors might be influencing what's happening. The problem is that most of the real damage from the minimum wage is going to take place in the long run. In the short run, if you force employers to increase their wages, they have a particular way of doing things. And in the short run, they're just going to have to swallow those increased costs. In the long run, that increased wage that they're being forced to pay is going to get them thinking about alternatives. And those alternatives include labor-reducing technologies, which you're seeing, for example, in fast food restaurants all over Europe where they have high minimum wages. In those places, they no longer have cashiers taking orders. They actually have touch screens doing so. Outsourcing some tasks to overseas workers. And again, it may not be firing necessarily, but not hiring. A lot of the research out there shows that the biggest effects aren't on firing, but are in fact on the lack of job creation that results from an increase in the minimum wage. Now, here's what it comes down to. A lot of economists and people can disagree about this issue because the fact is the minimum wage will improve the lives of a lot of people. In fact, there's a good chance that it will improve the lives of more people than it will harm. The question is, how do you weigh the costs of unemployment to those who are harmed and the increase in the wage from those who do better? And that's a decision that each one of you has to make yourself. Those are the trade-offs that you have to face. The cost to the individual of unemployment for me are incredibly high. You have a deterioration of skills, which makes it harder. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's harder and harder for you to get a job once you've lost your job. There's a loss of confidence and optimism. There's a deterioration of physical and mental health. Employers oftentimes pass on employees who have suffered long spells of unemployment. So for me personally, the money that's lost by people who have been unemployed isn't really the issue. It's the human cost involved in this unemployment and the inability of our most vulnerable workers to actually be able to get experience in the workforce and move themselves up. The cost to society, I'm going to skip because I'm running out of time, but they're substantial. You'll have to take my word for it. And the problem isn't just unemployment, okay? You know, oftentimes people who say, well, yes, there may be some unemployment, but you know, there's less unemployment because employees are less likely to go looking for other jobs. Well, employees are less likely to go looking for other jobs when they have a high wage job. Yeah, maybe because they're making a high wage, but they could get that high wage anywhere. The fact is that they're less likely to look for other jobs because those jobs don't exist. And what that means is that decreased job turnover means it's less likely that folks are finding jobs that fit their talents, and it's also more likely that you're going to see firms better able to exploit their workers for fear in those workers that they're going to be unemployed. Henry Ford did not raise the wage to twice the going rate because he wanted people to afford his cars. He raised the wage so that nobody would quit. He desperately wanted to maintain loyalty amongst his workers. You also have potential increased hiring of illegal immigrants, decreased hiring of legal immigrants, which is a huge issue, I think, for Alaska, given that Alaska desperately needs an influx of immigrant labor, both culturally, I think, and to promote value-based manufacturing or value-added manufacturing. Increased prices for goods produced by higher labor. This is my favorite. You know, we have this idea. I've got 1 minute left, so I'm going to skip a bunch of important stuff. But this is what I want to stress, okay? We have this idea that the minimum wage is going to help people, and it absolutely is. But someone is going to have to pay that cost for those folks to make more money. Who's going to pay that cost? Well, what we would like is that Walmart and Walmart's shareholders pay that cost, or that the shareholders of McDonald's pay that cost. But that's, in fact, not what's going to happen. In large part, McDonald's and Walmart are going to attempt to pass on those costs, those extra costs, to their workers, not to their workers, to their consumers, which are oftentimes the people that you're trying to help. Now, I do want to jump ahead real quick and suggest, oh boy, I've got a lot more, boy, obviously I'm usually doing 75 minutes at a time, 15's a little tight, okay? But I did want to suggest something. You know, this is a problem that absolutely needs to be solved, and I've got 15 seconds, so I'll stress it. Wage subsidies are the answer. Whether it's the earned income tax credit or it's direct subsidies to employers, these things also raise wages, but do so and increase employment as opposed to actually increasing unemployment. Hopefully during the question and answer, somebody will give me that question so I can pontificate more broadly on that. But the point is that this is a real problem. And it needs solving, but every solution is not created equal. And the very worst thing about the minimum wage, in my opinion, is the fact that it gives the impression we're actually doing something to help when there are so many better solutions that are out there.
Thank you very much. We'll turn to the direct exchange between the panelists. I think at this point we'd like to ask...
can you load mine back up? Because it's part of a question I want to ask. Now, you bring up the earned income tax credit, and that's a common response from folks that if you're using the wrong hammer, you ought to do the earned income tax credit. But who pays for the earned income tax credit? Taxpayers do. And I'd just like you to look at this. When you're basically talking $54 billion for an average benefit under the current system, people talk about we should expand it. An average benefit to the family with children of $29.05 a year, that works out to $1.40 an hour. And single childless people, the maximum is $487 a year. To do anything for these people that's remotely close to a $2 raise in the minimum wage, you'd have to double that. Where's that another $54 billion gonna come from on top of all the subsidies we already provide to these employers to pay their employees health care?
Would it be rude for me to ask a question?
Yeah, that's the question. How do you respond to that? Okay. Where's the money gonna come from? It's gonna come from the taxpayers
Where's the money going to come from to pay the higher wages to workers with a higher minimum wage?
It's obviously going to come from the employers, and some of that will be passed on to the consumers.
Who oftentimes are the people that you're attempting to help.
They're a part of it, sure.
Okay. So you asked who pays the earned income tax credit. The earned income tax credit is paid out of federal revenues. Federal revenues come from taxes, and taxes are typically in this country paid in large part by the wealthiest members of our society. If you're talking about...
Hold on.
Well, I didn't know that I would have to bring a slide for that. I mean, I thought that was fairly common knowledge. We have a highly progressive tax system in the United States, correct?
Sure, but it's also gamed for the top 1% to 5%. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
That is another debate for sure that we could have about how we close these loopholes. But I would say that if what you're interested in doing is actually addressing inequality, that if you have one option where you're raising wages, a large portion of the cost of doing so is being passed on to the folks that you're trying to help, and then you have this alternative. The bottom 50% of American taxpayers pay very, very little in the way of federal taxes. In fact, a large portion of them come out net ahead. So the result is that you've got two policies that are aimed at doing the same thing. One of them is paid for primarily by wealthy people who pay federal taxes who tend to be wealthier. And the other, we can't be entirely sure, is being paid by those same folks. It's just, if you attempt to, for example, increase the minimum wage, we have this idea that McDonald's, for example, is going to suffer and their shareholders are going to suffer. The fact is, McDonald's is franchised, and those are individual franchise owners. And the average profit margin on a McDonald's franchise is about 2.6%. There's simply no way that they're going to be able to compete with higher wage type restaurants at that profit margin if you impose.
So we should continue to subsidize those franchisees and the corporation with $1.2 billion in public assistance, so their workers can subsist?
This is Well, we have a phrase for this in economics, but it involves a swear word that I don't think would actually pass the FCC muster. Tax incidence or benefit incidence is a pain. It's a real pain. You cannot give money to poor people without Walmart benefiting from it. You can't. You cannot do food stamps without it making it easier for employers to pay their employees less. It can't be done.
And Walmart gets 18% of the food
stamps. I agree with you. Yeah. I think it's grotesque. I think it's wrong. I think it's awful. All those things are true. But anytime you choose to give subsidies to the poor, you're making it easier for the poor to work for less. And as a result of that, you're going to see, if you employ poor people, anything that helps poor people makes it so that you have to pay less.
Now, I know this is question time, but I think this is healthy that we're having the back and forth, Taylor. And David Newmark, who you quote, and your guy, and I think the more credible of many of the people on the other side. Here's what he said, you know, about the EITC, earned income tax credit. By increasing labor supply, which we'd all agree is a good thing, making work pay and bringing more people into the labor force, the EITC also lowers wage offers in the low-wage job market. He quote, there may be an argument for coupling the EITC with a higher minimum wage. But to be clear, he holds to his guns, to be clear, the higher minimum wage entails some job loss.
Oh, absolutely.
But to the notion that just doubling the EITC is going to make everything right is just absurd. It doesn't even come close to a mere $2 increase.
Can I get my gizmo back?
Oh, yeah.
Let me step in here a sec on format. The idea was question, answer, and rebuttal.
Very good, very good.
So, no, and it's been very helpful so far. So, Kyle, at this point,
sure,
we'd like to invite you to pose a question to Ed. He'll have 3 minutes to answer, and then you'll have 3 minutes to explore or challenge his answer. So let's try and hold to that.
Okay.
Kyle, your question, please.
Sure. So you think a $15 minimum wage would increase unemployment?
I think there's definitely a chance, as a statewide minimum wage, given our industry mix, that it could. I mean, I am not probably as maybe out as far as some folks are in what might be tried. I think Seattle's probably going to work, you know, because they have a long phase in. But in this state, we have a lot of low-wage industries, and we probably would have some of the effects. I don't discount your theories or even Newmark's contentions out of hand. As some on the other side, not necessarily you, do with ours. I admit that they have some possibilities, you know, maybe even probabilities of higher. You know, the facile comment that people make, well, and I heard this when I was getting signatures, well, if it's such a great idea, why don't we make it $100 an hour? Well, that's, you know, that's ridiculous. There's some point where the job loss impacts are not offset by the greater good. I mean, look at the CBO study, which you touched on. I mean, that was the other side thought that was great, you know, because it showed a potential 500,000 loss of jobs, you know, which is basically 2 months job growth, and that we need every job we can get these days in a normal economy, and what we've been posting the last few months. But, you know, Goldman Sachs, again, not a tool of the working class, their response to the right after that study was economists are split on the question. It's Goldman Sachs Global Macro Research, March 25th. Economists are split on the question of whether minimum wage would hike employment. In our view, the CBO's recent estimate of a 500,000 hit, 0.3%, is likely a bit toward the upper end of reasonable estimates, because both because many studies find no significant impact of wage hikes on employment, and because the offsetting boost to demand is likely to be larger than usual at present. Any impact on the monthly payroll numbers would likely be small relative to normal volatility and would likely be concentrated in the retail, trade, and hospitality sectors. I mean, that's because, I mean, whoever you look at, Economic Policy Institute, David Cooper, John Schmidt, I mean, these are guys who are actually right here. If you want to see, you know, meta-analysis that counteracts the laundry list that Dr. Hampton just posted, you know, it basically rebuts a lot of those studies, including Newmark, who again is more credible than a lot of the other ones. But in those studies, it's conceded, and I'm willing to concede that a modest minimum wage increase, which is what we are proposing, $2, it's 13, it's a total of 26% over 2 years with a 2 year phase in. I think anybody would agree, especially with the cost of living in this state, that that qualifies as a modest proposal, and there are ample studies and even some concession by the other side that the job losses are negligible, and of course our side says probably offset by the increase in economic activity engendered by the better spending power of low-wage workers who spend every dime they've got because have to.
So if Congress chooses to pass a $10.10 federal minimum wage and the ballot measure passes, that would result in an $11.10 minimum wage.
Eventually, I don't think anybody realistically expects the 10-10 to take effect. I mean, given the current alignment, I don't know when, but I mean, the earliest would be 2018. And yes, if that happened, let's say in mid-2018, the following January 1st, which would be 4 years from now, more than 4 years from now, Alaska would be 11-10. That's right.
And you're comfortable that
I'm comfortable with that. Alaska was comfortable, and our economy did pretty damn well with the 50 cents over federal for a long time when it actually meant something. And this is really just an updating of that concept. If the rest of the country, you know, if Mississippi, if other places, some states that we compete for certain things with, are paying 10-10, Alaska can afford 11-10.
You may be right, actually. The fact is that we are a very high-wage state in a lot of ways, and it's very possible you can set a minimum wage that doesn't have any employment effects. If we were to set a minimum wage at $2, for example, the entire labor market would shrug because there's no job out there now that anybody would necessarily take for $2. It's just not going to drive those jobs out of the market. And it may be that this increase that we're talking about would cause a relatively small increase in unemployment. Possibly. I'm not entirely sure, and these are questions that are difficult to answer for our specific state without having any sort of data. But I come back again to the fact that the biggest issue here for me isn't so much that the minimum wage would cause damage, as it is that we are being damaged by the knowledge that the minimum wage is going to make that significant a difference. For me, the EITC or any sort of wage subsidies that are out there, those actually increase demand for labor or increase demand of laborers to actually work. It costs society the same thing. It's just that the costs aren't hidden in the way that they are with the minimum wage. They're actually being paid by taxpayers, which, as I said, tend to be folks who have more resources and therefore are actually subject to the sort of income redistribution that I think we both want. My biggest fear in supporting something like the minimum wage, and I'm going to reveal a little bit of my cynicism here, it is a midterm election year, and this is what we're getting from the Democratic Party, is this idea for a minimum wage increase. The reason why is because it doesn't require a tax increase, and understanding the cost to society and real human beings is fairly difficult for folks who haven't taken my incredible Principles of Economics course. and so, it's actually a little bit disturbing to me that people who I know, and I know Ed here, I know absolutely deeply feel the need for some sort of economic reform that helps people who are worse off in our society, who are the victims of 30 years of globalization, which is fantastic, but has really done a number on our low-wage workers in this country. It upsets me that this is the solution that we've been given, especially from people who I think know that we can do a lot better.
Okay, well, let me continue my answer because we're in the question time. Just briefly, Taylor, and I have no problem with the way this is going. That's fine. I don't know what the hell the midterm election has to do with it. What people are saying who are promoting this, and we started promoting this, you know, just serendipitously before there was a whole lot of attention on the minimum wage. It was the right time to do it for Alaska because it was 5 years since it had been done, or it will be 5 years. But to say that employers should be paying, and yes, they may pass on the costs, but you have a Walmart Supercenter or a Sam's Club across the street from a Costco that is in direct competition, especially with the Sam's Club, the same industry, and here's one employer paying a living wage, probably doesn't even have any significant reliance for its employees to live on government programs that all the taxpayers pay. Yeah, people that have more pay more, but as a percentage, you know, we all know Warren Buffett's analogy, you know, and I think that makes a lot of sense to a lot of us, that his secretary pays a higher tax rate than he does. I think that's absurd, and that's what people don't want to see. They want to see an end to these subsidies. There's always going to be some subsidies, but for the taxpayer to underwrite, I mean, we come at this, obviously, from completely different directions. For the taxpayer to underwrite the wage bill of the largest employer in the country is ridiculous. When there's competitors competing head-to-head, making a profit against, you know, at, in the same industry, but not sucking off the government programs and profiting that way at our expense. I mean, it's there. It's happening. Everybody knows it. Costco, the Wall Street analysts, you know, was super profitable about 5 years ago, but they hated it because it didn't screw its employees as much as it could have. I mean, that was out there. That was published. You know, well, it's weak management. They pay too much to people, and the CEO only takes $260,000 a year. Hey, that's my kind of company.
Kyle, again, I want you to treat that as another question. Now it's your opportunity to respond.
Well, I think it should be stressed, actually, that over 50% of employers that actually pay the minimum wage to their employers are firms that are under 50 workers. It's very easy to demonize.
That's not the case in Alaska. If you had a prototypical actual minimum wage worker, of which there's only 2,500 monthly average, according to Department of Labor, they ran some numbers, the prototypical is going to be a processor working for a multi-billion-dollar multinational industry out in Dutch Harbor. Because what do they pay out there? When I was commissioner 12 years ago, they used to pay a quarter over minimum wage. I asked a fellow who signed a petition in Ketchikan, said he worked in the processor down there and in the winter went out, you know, for pollock. And he said, well, what do they pay now? He said, $7.75. I said, really? And you've been out there 3 years? He goes, yeah, well, every year they take $5 off my room and board. It used to be illegal for them to charge room and board, but they rammed it through a regulation change in 2003 and basically obviated the effect of the last minimum wage increase by being able to charge these people who have no alternative their room and board fee. So that's what he gets. That's how they do their business.
So if you increase...
So these are not mom and pops. The mom and pops are the people I met who, you know, in large part are paying more than the minimum wage right now. That's so, in Alaska.
So
and
you,
I need to see, if it's my turn for a question, I need to see some real
on,
Alaska
hang on.
Data.
No, let me step in. I think Kyle was trying to get an answer in, didn't get chance to complete his answer. So let's go back to Kyle, if you had additional framework on this topic, and then we'll move on to another. I've lost track of who had how many questions.
What's the nature of these workers who are working for $7.75? Where are they from?
I don't think it matters where they're from, but if they're in the seafood industry, I think what you're getting at is probably a very large percentage of them are not Alaska residents. Although out in Dutch Harbor, over the years, that's become, if not a year-round, close to it. A lot of them, you know, probably have more become Alaskans. But at times, the seafood processing, back when we were trying, and the current administration is also launching a new initiative, we try this every few years to Alaskanize. And the CDQ groups have done a good job, obviously. At much higher wages.
Not where I was going. Now, my guess is a lot of them are immigrants who don't have a whole lot of options for other type employment. That's who I understand are working in a lot of these different canneries and
fish. That would certainly be a big part of it.
You don't think that an $11.10 minimum wage for fish workers would drive, automation of these processes more, basically eliminate a lot of these hands-on jobs in favor of automation, possibly even increasing costs sufficient that foreign vessels become more profitable for, say, McDonald's in the pollock fishery? You don't see that a $4 increase in the wages of these low-wage
I think it would be hard for to do because that is a very mechanized and automated industry already. Mm-hmm. Anything that could be done overseas, I mean, one of the most fascinating things I ran into when I was commissioner was they were chums, fish was cheap then. Chums were being frozen, shipped to China, having the pin bones removed, probably by prisoners, and refrozen, shipped back, and still sold at a profit. Of course, chums were only 25 or 40 cents a pound at the time.
I would expect to see a lot more of that, actually, to
increase the minimum wage.
Well, I
think it's
probably
happening as much as it can happen wherever it can happen already. And I don't know that, you know, an increase in the minimum wage, $4 maybe, but it's not, you know, well, it'd be $3.50, $3.35 if they're making $7.75 now. That's right.
Right.
Let me thank you both for spirited debate thus far.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with former Labor Commissioner Ed Flanagan and UAA economist Kyle Hampton. Flanagan and Hampton are debating Ballot Measure 3, Alaska's minimum wage initiative, which will be on the November ballot. This debate was hosted by Alaska Common Ground. It was recorded July 30th at the Wilda Marston Theater. Former Alaska Common Ground board member Taylor Brelsford served as moderator.
Please take a second, take a drink of water. Now we're going to have some really hard questions from the audience. So this question, I will read two related questions having to do with the social safety net. And I think what I'd like to do is to ask Ed to answer first. And our timing on questions from the moderator was 3-minute responses, more or less. Ed first, and then Kyle. So will an increased minimum wage push typical minimum wage families over the threshold for programs like WIC, Section 8 housing, Medicaid, et cetera? And please comment on the cost to society for those who don't make enough income and have to rely on food stamps and other governmental programs in order to survive. So the relationship of the social safety net to minimum wage.
Can I add? Yeah, it varies on the program. And one of the neat things about EITC is that it always pays to make another dollar. It's not a dollar for dollar loss. It's not a cliff that you fall off of. Food stamps, well, that program's under challenges. I believe there's a sliding scale there, too. So for the most part, and now with Medicaid was one where it was an issue, but I think now with Affordable Care Act, that is less of a problem. So I think to the first part of the question, it's not an issue. Now, what was the second part about subsidies?
Please comment on the costs to society for those who don't make enough income and have to rely on food stamps and other governmental programs in order to survive.
Okay, well, here, thank you very much for that question, because I hadn't gotten to this slide. We all subsidize employers of low-wage workers. Here's what it looks like. Walmart employees, $6.2 billion. Medicaid and CHIP, earned income tax credit, and food stamps. I couldn't find a breakdown on that. And that is from Americans for Tax Fairness. Public assistance for fast food workers from the UC Berkeley Labor Center. About $7 billion, $3.9 billion in Medicaid and CHIP, that's the Denali Kid Care here in Alaska, that's a child health improvement, I think, plan, $1.04 billion in earned income tax credit, $1.91 billion in food stamps. McDonald's is 1.2 of that $7 billion. 52% of the families of frontline fast food workers are enrolled in one or more public assistance programs versus 25% of the workforce as a whole. I think that answers the question.
Thank you. Kyle, do you want to take a turn?
So increasing the minimum wage solves this problem how?
Because there will be some reduction in those benefits. Again, not on a dollar for dollar basis, but you would see reductions in the earned income tax credit as some people made more money and had less dependence on it. Now, they might be at the plateau point of it, you know, and not get out of that, but they probably would if they're at 975. Food stamps would be reduced. And you know, what if we only saved $1 billion of that and diverted it to the Highway Trust Fund, where that creates 13,000 construction-related jobs? And this is just one, granted, the largest employer in the country with 1.2, 1.3 million employees and one large industry. But, I mean, that's only part of it. That $54 billion is just the cost for the earned income tax credit. Again, a great program, but if we can reduce dependence on that through employers paying at least a better share of the subsistence needs of their workers than the taxpayer, I think that's a good thing.
Kyle, additional comments on this question?
No, honestly, all the things that you're saying, the results from the increase in the earned income tax credit would be the same, obviously, except for the fact that the earned income tax credit costs would go up. But of course, there are costs involved in reducing these costs as well. If you increase the minimum wage, you increase the price of food, you increase the cost to small business owners, you also drive some people out of the workforce, which and they're not able to pay any taxes at all and require more of this sort of assistance. So again, I agree with everything that you're saying. This is an anathema. It's absolutely terrible, but I'm not sure, again, that the minimum wage is the way to solve this problem. In fact, in many ways, I think it exacerbates the problem by increasing the incidence of poverty, by increasing the incidence of unemployment.
We're going to turn to another question. Thank you. And this time I'll ask Kyle for you to respond first, followed by Ed. The question is this: would more widespread unionization, including unskilled jobs in retail restaurant trades, be a more effective response to low wages than a legislatively induced minimum wage? Kyle, your thoughts first, and then we'll turn to Ed.
Italy, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden. None of these countries would ever be considered a place where workers are not very well taken care of. None of these countries have a minimum wage. What they do have are laws that promote collective bargaining within industries. And so I would say that there are certain things that can be done to improve the bargaining position of workers. That would be a far better solution for increasing wages and the well-being of workers than the minimum wage.
Ed? I wouldn't necessarily disagree. I mean, if we had vitiated our labor law over the last 33 years, primarily, it might be a different story. But when we had stronger unions, a stronger labor law, and a more effective right to organize, raising the minimum wage was barely even a controversial issue. It was a bipartisan agreement, you know, just that, hey, it's time to raise it. It's only become a political football, maybe coincidentally, since 1981, with the decline of unions, and has lost so much ground to be almost meaningless.
Thanks. Let's keep moving. Question from the audience. This time we'll start with Ed, turn to Kyle second. Data from the Alaska Judicial Council shows a big correlation between poverty and minor crime, especially theft. Would minor crime be reduced if more people had a living wage?
I go first?
Yes.
Okay. I'd like to think so. I haven't really studied that issue. I mean, folks have come to the minimum wage cause, you know, from different venues, and I really haven't look at any literature with that, so I wouldn't want to just, you know, talk through my hat here. But it seems like if folks are better provided for, there'd be at least some reduction in crime. It wasn't pathological behavior, it was driven by absolute need or desperation. But I really, you know, don't have any firm, thoughts to offer on that.
High wages definitely are correlated with a decrease in crime, absolutely, but an even greater correlate with decreased crime is increased employment. In fact, there's a significant improvement once you start improving the employment level at any wage level in the reduction of crime. And so that would be one of my big arguments for not attempting a policy that could increase unemployment.
Okay. Let's see, this question we'll start with Kyle and turn to Ed second. The present minimum wage has been in effect for quite a while. We also have had small annual inflation of 2 or 3%. This cumulatively erodes the purchasing power of the minimum wage. It all adds up. What's the best way to fix this? P.S. My wage on a first job was 55 cents an hour.
Who are you? I could probably pick you out.
Might have been pretty good for all I know. To see the person. this is for me first?
You first. So this had to do with the erosion over time.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. The minimum wage has, if you look at the minimum wage in real terms, it's this buzzsaw. There's an improvement and then it decreases in value. Then an improvement and it decreases in value. So absolutely, you've definitely seen a decrease in the buying power of the minimum wage. Again, I must stress, I am all for increasing the wages of low-earning, low-skilled, or blue-collar workers within our society. But the minimum wage is not going to do that without unemployment, whereas wage subsidies would. And so if that is your primary concern, is the eroding purchasing power, I think improving that purchasing power could be done through other means.
Ed?
Well, minimum wage, as Kyle, I believe, mentioned, puts a floor under the wage system. The market still works. I mean, our minimum wage is dysfunctional in many areas of Alaska, so you have a de facto or functional minimum wage that's higher. It's less than $9.75 in most places, not all, certainly not in rural Alaska. I had a representative out there during the legislative debate say, hell, I'm voting against this because I don't like what they're trying to do. He says, but out in Bethel, the box boy makes 15 bucks an hour.
Sure.
And it only makes sense. But it gets eroded by inflation. It's certainly happened here. You hear a lot of reference to 1968, and 1010 is an attempt to get close. I think the 1968 minimum wage, and that's when I started working, $1.60 an hour. You could get 5 gallons of gas in New York for $1.60. You could probably get 3 gallons of milk. Milk and gas weren't the same price then like
they
are now.
But what kind of mileage were you getting?
But, I'm not getting much better now in my Ford pickup, but that's my fault. But you could get an apartment for, a decent apartment. It wasn't fancy. It was in a, semi-safe neighborhood studio apartment, before we called them efficiencies, for 80 or 90 bucks a month, for 60 hours of minimum wage. HUD now, 1146, fair market value for a two-bedroom apartment. How many hours at 775 do you have to work to get that, or to even come close to meeting the 30-cent housing? But, employment is a big part of it. Kyle's right, I don't disagree, but, the talk about, here's what happened. This is, again, Goldman Sachs first did an analysis of December and then January, looking at the states, 13 of which raised their minimum wage, some because they do it every year because they do inflation proofing like we should do, like we had in the law, but it was repealed before it ever got to take effect. And if you look, the 13 states, only one of them had job loss, Jersey. They all had more significant job growth than as a whole. They looked at 1 month, and then the Center for Economic Policy Research looked at the last 5 months of last year, the first 5 months of this year. And again, it's early days, but if everything Kyle's saying is true, you should have seen less employment growth. The employment growth in the 37 states that did not increase their minimum wage was 0.61%. It was 0.85% in the 13 states that did. Washington State, the highest minimum wage for the last 15 years, has not quite as high as California, but damn near the highest job growth. Nevada, of course, they're just they're in the phase where they're finally coming out of the recession. But Washington is a good case in point for a strong, one of the first to do a CPI minimum wage that had tremendous job growth compared to the rest of the country, even relatively speaking, through the recession, with the highest minimum wage in the country and a valid cost of living adjustment.
Thank you. Here's another question, and I think this time, Ed, we'll start with you and turn to Kyle second. How will the minimum wage increase affect retired people? So side effects on retired people.
The ones that are having to work low-wage jobs to get by will certainly benefit. Other than that, we didn't see great price increases. Kyle will say that they're going to be hurt by inflation, but again, Goldman Sachs predicts even at the 10-10, were that to come to pass on the federal level, a 0.1% inflation attributable to that increase. I don't know that there'd be much effect, but the many that are still required to work to supplement their pensions, if they're lucky to have them, they're more probably living just on Social Security if they have to be out taking low-wage work, they're going to benefit tremendously from an increase, or if they're over 975, from the spillover or trickle-up effect that is well-documented for the indirect effect.
Kyle, your thoughts on effects on retired people?
You got me. You totally got me. Yes, I was definitely going to say that. It will. You're absolutely right. There will be very little effect on inflation from a minimum wage, which is, again, I'm trapped here. This is a semester's worth of macroeconomics. Inflation is at all times a monetary phenomenon, but whatever. The fact is that you will see targeted inflation in certain sectors. I'm not going to keep going back, but I do have a slide about research on food prices and restaurant food prices and their increase as a result of increases in the minimum wage. There are significant sector increases, especially with food, that I think are going to affect people that are on that don't necessarily have a steady income that's coming in. So on that, I think we would have to respectfully disagree. As far as food prices going up, especially in service industries, the retirees could see an increase in costs here in Alaska.
Okay. Next question. Estimates for a living wage in Alaska are as high as $21 an hour, largely due to high costs for consumer goods. Given that the wage increase proposed doesn't even cover the living wage before the likely increase in prices, how does the wage increase justify the potential loss of jobs? And I think Kyle will go to you first.
It doesn't. $21 is
living wage. So talk to me about living wage versus minimum wage strategies.
It's essentially, it's just a matter of language. It's like a depression, recession, tomato, tomato. It's just, it's marketing mostly. The idea of a living wage, this would, that somebody figured out somewhere that this is what would be necessary to survive on. But it does allow me to mention one thing that I didn't mention before, and that is, you know, Seattle's gonna try this $15 minimum. They're going to try it, and I could not be more excited that it's not happening here. And I couldn't be more excited that it's happening, period. I'm very happy that it's happening because I think we need experiments. We need policy experiments, and I'm very curious to see what happens in those places. My guess is that maybe you don't see a huge decrease in employment, in large part because the wage there is already pretty high. But what you will see over time is a change in the cultural fabric of that city. It will drive immigrants out of the city for the most part that have been a huge part of creating the culture of that city. It will drive immigrant businesses out of those places. And you will essentially, what I'm predicting, and you can all check my prediction 20 years from now, but what I'm predicting is that you will have a core in the middle, which are very well-heeled, well-compensated Seattleites buying very expensive coffee and meals. And then all the hard work will be done in a large ring outside the city. Especially the immigrants that are out there. When I moved up here, my first thought when I got here was, my gosh, you know, especially having visited Canada, whatever we can do in this community, in this state, to encourage more immigration. We're a wonderfully diverse community already. I think 70 languages spoken in the Anchorage School District.
100, I think.
100 languages spoken. And that was one of the things that really appealed to me when I moved up here. But the folks who tend to be hurt by these sorts of policies, these minimum wage policies, are the folks who are the most vulnerable, who are willing to work for the least. And we may look at what they're working for and the wages that they're earning and say, you know, I'm very uncomfortable with the fact that they're not making more. But mandating that they make more doesn't always result. In fact, you know, oftentimes does not result in them making more. In fact, results in them making nothing and making it very impossible for them to be able to find the jobs here that would help us to have that sort of diverse community.
Well, I don't know that 15 is even a living wage in Seattle. It probably isn't. And you're right, the de facto minimum wage there is probably 12, yep. 12 bucks. But I totally disagree. I mean, it's fascinating to take that air link, you know, from SeaTac up to Seattle, and you go through almost four or five different cultures. I mean, it's amazing. And all I see with those folks, you're in King County, yeah, getting, well, Seattle, if they're in the $15, I think they are, if they would be affected,
yeah, SeaTac, sure.
Is better standard of living for those folks, more customers with money in their pocket for those immigrant businesses. I mean, I think, and the fascinating thing about Seattle is that it was really a negotiated settlement. I mean, there's a suit from the franchise industry, but the restaurant owners, some of them, one of the larger restaurant owners, started paying his people 15 already. Now, he was an outlier, you know, and with tipped employees. No tip credit there like here. Which I think, even though 43 states have it, is an abomination that, you know, you can pay waiters and waitresses in most states as little as $2.13 an hour, and then they're good luck, you know, they better get the rest from the customer. But in Seattle, they phased it in, you know, they phased it in longer for the restaurant industry, and the city, you know, has a right to decide that, hey, we want to try this social experiment, and I'm really curious to see it. I mean, I don't make any pretense that what we're doing is a living wage. I don't buy the part, if I heard part of that question, how do you justify the unemployment? Because, you know, I won't pull the slide up again, but been there, done that, in Alaska, 27%, you know, New Year's Eve, when the ball fell, 3 hours later or whatever in New York, you know, Alaskan minimum wage was $5.65, and 2 minutes later, 1 second later, it was $7.15, and the low-wage industries, wages were up, and jobs were up. A lot of other factors operate.
A lot of other.
And look at 2004, though. I have the 2004 numbers. I didn't have a slide for them. Continued growth in both employment and in wages. Actually, processors, the employment, fish food processors, in 2004, the employment went up. Wage, average monthly wage went down 114 a month. You know, maybe there's less effort or something like that, but the number of jobs was up. So we've been there and done that. I mean, quantity of jobs up, quality of jobs in terms of pay up. I think most Alaskans will take that deal.
Can I address that?
Sure.
In May 2014, Northwest Asian Weekly spoke to some hospitality workers in SeaTac after the imposition of their minimum wage. And this was the exchange. Are you happy with the $15 wage? It sounds good, but it's not good. Why? I lost my 401k, my health insurance, my paid holiday and vacation, and no more free food. The hotel used to feed her. Now she has to bring her own food. No overtime. Also, what else? I have to pay for parking. And the reason why I bring this up is because one thing that I wanted to stress, I know I've been harping a lot on unemployment, and I think unemployment is a big deal and it has serious harms to society. But even when you don't have unemployment, an increase in these wages, again, it's like the wave hitting the wall. That force doesn't just disappear. It manifests itself in different ways. It manifests itself in a decrease in the treatment of workers because those workers are basically afraid to lose that $15 job because essentially there's a line of folks who are willing to take it, willing to work for less. These economic forces don't disappear. They just manifest themselves in ways that you may not always expect. And so if you do impose these sorts of minimum wage, yeah, maybe you don't get so much unemployment, but you do give your employers a lot more leeway to push around their workers, and that's one more cost that has to be counted.
Thanks. Well, Kyle, I mean, we're going back and forth a little bit here. Just give me a minute.
That's fair.
You know, like many advocates from the other side, you key on unemployment, and unemployment at any wage is better than none. Well, you know, we have, as you conceded, we have a terrible problem of people working their butts off for totally inadequate wages. And if we drive more people into that employment, it's a good thing they're going to work. But if we're driving them into a broken system already of impecunious, you know, employment and inadequate wage and subsidy, all we're doing is supersizing, so to speak, the problem that we have. I mean, you've got to address the problem that you put the system, that the employment world that you want these people to get into. It can't just be the law of the jungle. We've got to put a floor. Right now it's a goddamn sub-basement, but we got to put a floor under the market and under the wage system. Market's still going to operate, but we're going to say, here's where you don't go any lower. Now, the 15, I mean, that's one story. There's probably a lot of other stories there. SeaTac was real interesting. One of the most popular eateries in SeaTac was one of the prime, did commercials for that. He said, hey, when these guys, and we know what precipitated that, family wage jobs for baggage handlers were thousands of them, or hundreds of them, maybe, were contracted out. Went from 15 to 8 or 9 bucks overnight. And he said, guess what? I got nobody coming in my bar and restaurant, you know, because they can't afford it. So, yeah, he supported the $15 an hour minimum wage, one of the leading small businessmen in SeaTac, that city.
Let's move to another question. Do the states with higher minimum wages than Alaska also subsidize food, energy, housing, and transportation and medical care to the extent that Alaska does? And will the increase in minimum wage take Alaskans off of the general handouts, generous handouts that the state gives? I'm reading these.
Well, you have to name, is it me first or Kyle this time?
Let's go with you.
Okay.
You're already started.
You'd have to name all those programs, but Alaska does the minimum possible, certainly in the case of health care, with the refusal of the governor to do the Medicaid expansion. Virtually all the programs where we give money away, not all of them, but most of them are federal programs that are the same across the states. So I think it's fairly safe to say, and I could be wrong, but that in most cases, in most programs, we are stingier than other states. So I think the whole question is kind of specious.
Okay. Kyle, your thoughts?
Well, I know that a lot of these policies, and I'm a new Chichaco, only 4 years here, but I do know that a lot of these policies that subsidize living in Alaska are for rural residents. And Ed, I don't want to mischaracterize what you said, but the minimum wage that we're talking about here would probably do nothing to help rural Alaskans, right?
It wouldn't in most of the communities out there. Like I said, you know, nobody's working for $7.75, but there is a connection that a lot of folks from there. You know, Anchorage is the biggest native village
right. In
Alaska. You
right.
know, Fairbanks is second biggest. And so folks from those families certainly come into, actually starting to have a lot of folks out in the Mat-Su from the
send money
Bush.
Back.
They send money back.
Okay.
And they are
sense.
In the low-wage economy. Many of them, not
yeah.
all of them, certainly. I mean, there's people that come
that.
Here that are working out Nana, you know, Cominco and stuff. But
yeah, that's a great point. But as for those folks who do live in rural Alaska, the minimum wage isn't really going to do much to raise them. those of them who actually have jobs. And that's one of the things that's kind of frustrating is that, you know, when I'm looking at the real problems that minimum wage is supposed to solve, I see most of those problems in rural Alaska. One number that I didn't actually get to bring up is the fact that nationwide, 70% of folks under the poverty line are not working at all, and so would not be helped by any sort of increase in the minimum wage. And these folks in rural Alaska who are not being helped by the minimum wage, I would like to think, actually, would still be helped by these policies that are directed at rural poverty directly.
Kyle, there's plenty of folks hurting in Anchorage and Fairbanks and other areas of the state, in communities right in you know, neighborhoods right in Anchorage that are I don't have to tell you, they're in as desperate straits as anybody in rural Alaska, and they would benefit from this.
I have no doubt about that.
How many people will lose their jobs when small businesses can't afford to pay more? They will have to cut employees. Kyle, I think this comes back to a topic we've touched, but if you wouldn't mind, please summarize your thoughts on that.
Yeah, real quickly, over half of, and again, it's very difficult to find Alaska-specific statistics when it comes to this sort of thing, but over half of the minimum wage jobs that are out there are with firms that are less than 50 employers, and a lot of those tend to be fast food restaurants or ethnic restaurants here in town, and the profit margins for those businesses are extremely low. They would have to look into some sort of automation or possibly even cutting workers and asking workers to work harder if they are forced to pay that higher wage.
Okay. Well, I just keep coming back to, you know, I hate to beat a live horse in my opinion, the example of what happened in 2002-2003. If the dire effects that Kyle predicts and projects from theory and from extrapolating possibly situations in other states had happened in Alaska, folks would have known about it in 2003. The folks who, you know, tried vehemently to oppose and stifle the law would have been back, you know, making the case that things were terrible, and it did not happen.
Can I address that?
Sure. So as we said, the minimum wage gets increased, and then its value decreases, presumably, right?
With inflation and production, absolutely.
Okay,
sure.
So in Alaskan history, at these times when inflation has decreased the value of the wages being earned by Alaskans, what's happened to employment?
Employment, at least for the last 20 years, has been, you know, fairly steady. 1-2% growth. You know, less than 2% is a lot. I mean, it's 1.5 is probably the average, and I could be wrong. I'm a little out of date, but that was our consistent. I mean, we had 22 after our big. We had our 2008, 1986
year. My house was built that year.
Yeah,
well, it's held together with chewing gum and baling
wire.
Yeah,
well, somebody, you know, there's a good chance, you know, a lot of houses in that year, the bank got them when people drove by and threw the keys at the door.
Right,
you know?
Absolutely.
My house in Fairbanks is one of those, you know.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, we've been through our big shakeout. You
right.
Know, and that's why we didn't have the big problem. But generally, that was a period where the minimum wage, it was the 80s.
Yeah.
You know, during the entire Reagan administration, there was no federal increase, and thus there was no Alaska increase. But, you know, in terms of what it's worth, I started to say before, and I got off track. In 68, you hear a lot about that, you know, that $1.60 in 1968 would be 10-something. Well, Alaska was 210 because of our 50 cents over. If you just go to Department of Labor and plug in 210 in 1968 and put that into 2014 dollars, it's like 1220 or 1230.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what it would be at. So we're getting back to the inflation erosion. That's just the way it is.
The reason why I bring it up is because a lot of, you know, you keep showing this fact that we had these increases in the minimum wage and nothing bad seemed to happen. But, you know, all of the research that I'm showing and most of the research that we do in economics, you know, the fact is there's a lot of different things happening at once, and you have to control for all of those factors. The fact is that job growth and economic growth in Alaska has been pretty strong. And assuming that, you said 12, how much do you think it was worth, about $12?
$2.10 in 1968 would be worth over $12.
My guess is in 1968, $12 was what it took to get people to move up here. And therefore, you wouldn't expect a minimum wage of that amount to actually be very binding. And my guess is that minimum wage didn't really raise too many incomes at that time because so many people were already making a wage that was either that or in excess. Am I mischaracterizing?
Well, I think taking $12 back there, I don't follow that. I mean, $2.10 was a lot, you know, was a lot more than it is today.
But what percentage of workers at that time in Alaskan workers in 1968 were actually making that $2.10?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I have no idea.
Here's a question for Dr. Hamilton. Could you expand
Hampton.
On Dr. Hampton?
All right.
Excuse me. I went to college in Hamilton.
See,
Freudian slip. Can you expand on and explain the connection, if any, between minimum wage and the cost of living? At what point does there need to be an increase in minimum wage? What is the maximum disparity between minimum wage and cost of living possible? Is there ever a point at which the minimum wage should be increased, and when?
Well, if it's not entirely obvious, I would do away with all minimum wages right off the bat. I know that's not a popular idea. I think that most people, their first thought when you start talking about eliminating the minimum wage is that people would pay 25 cents an hour and that so workers would be exploited. The fact of the matter is, how many workers in Alaska make the minimum wage currently?
2,500 on an average annual monthly.
Percentage-wise of the workforce?
Less than 1%.
Right. So the fact is, for 99% of workers, no minimum wage is necessary. Correct?
For not 99%, but probably 7 or 8%, there's not a functional minimum wage where
right.
there should be.
Okay.
And that's what we're doing. We're trying to establish a meaningful minimum wage, Kyle.
Uh-huh. I honestly think for most for all jobs that the price that emerges in those markets, if the price that would emerge in a market without the minimum wage is $7 for a particular worker, then if you apply an $11.10 minimum wage, I'm pretty sure that job is no longer going to exist. The problem is this. Look, we're upset that workers are making $7. You're upset, I'm upset about that, absolutely. I mean, it's an anathema. But the problem is that there are people in this world who can only produce $7.25 worth of value. I have a good friend, a hardcore Marxist labor economist, and she told me that she actually supports the minimum wage because it creates unemployment. Because it creates unemployment, it actually takes those people who are the least productive in society, who aren't able to warrant the $11 minimum wage, and actually drives them into public services where they can improve their productivity. I don't know if you're comfortable with that argument, but that is the argument that she's made. I think it's kind of cool, actually. But that's our problem, is that there are people who are making $7 and don't have the ability to negotiate the higher salaries above the minimum wage that 99% of workers are.
So people should go get training to improve their value. But how are they going to get it when they're only making $7 an hour and having to work 60 hours at two fast food joints?
You name it. Tell me a policy proposal where the federal government
pays. They are potentially worth more than that.
Absolutely.
And they're stifled and they're stymied by what the economic drudgery that they're caught in. And because we have a non-functional minimum wage.
So we'd like
to provide one last
opportunity for closing comments from the panelists. So 3 minutes to reiterate key points to summarize some of the recent discussion. Ed, would you go first? So 3 minutes.
No, I went first on the opening.
Yeah, I think that's
first. That's pretty standard procedure.
Yeah. Here we go. Kyle.
I know I didn't convince most of you. I understand that. Like I said, part of the reason why I became an economist was because when I saw these sorts of dynamics, when I came to understand that things that seemed so clearly to help people, so obvious to help people, actually in many cases made things worse and kept us from pursuing policies that could actually improve people's lives, I was blown away. And I really did feel like I had to tell everyone about it. And I do, every semester. Take my class, please. You have to understand that I think that everything that everybody who is here tonight wants is what I want too. I can't speak for the Restaurant Owners Association. I'm sure they're very cynical about this, and there will be people who will oppose this measure, who will do so on entirely selfish grounds, but I think that's true of the union support of the other side as well. But the fact is that I truly do believe that there are things that we can do that will make people better off, that will actually direct our efforts towards the poverty that we're all concerned about and the inequality that we're all concerned about without this scattershot approach that can oftentimes make our most vulnerable worse off. I want the same things that you guys want, and I know I come at it from a very bizarro economics world, but I believe this, and I hope that in some small way I've helped you to understand a little bit better where people on the other side are coming from.
Well, thank you. And Kyle, I think you certainly have achieved that. I'll never agree with you, but you advanced the arguments, I think, with a lot more eloquence and with at least some obvious compassion than I see from a lot of the folks you quoted up here. But I mean, we're a nation, we're a state, we're a society of laws. And, you know, Kyle probably, that was going to be one of my questions, I never even got to it, you know, he probably has an issue as a, you know, free market economist on child labor. You know, I mean, if somebody wants to pay a 12-year-old to do something, they ought to be able to do it. I don't know. Do you have any, you know, I shouldn't just attribute that to you. Do you have any opinion on child labor?
Is there a Fifth Amendment that I can cite in this case?
Anyway, and this is nothing different. I mean, I it's been, you know, since 1938. And again, let's remember when minimum wage happened. You know, we came back from we were coming back from something even worse than the economic, you know, horrors that we've experienced and been more spared from, thankfully, in Alaska than the rest of the country. But, I mean, in the 1930s, demand collapsed, and you know, one of the solutions, which, you know, had popular support and continues to have popular support, was that it's okay for government to set a floor, to set some minimum value. And it was very minimal when it started. I mean, 25 cents in 1938, I think, only equates to about $3.50 now. You know, we talk about 1968 as the high point. Well, of course, if you're starting a minimum wage program, you're going to start low, and then you get to where it's meaningful. But, I mean, this is, to me, and I think to a lot of people, a basic, it's economic, but it's also justice. It's also fairness. It's also basic humanity. Time out of people's lives and the payment for, you know, what is essential to all of us, work, has to provide some modicum of decent subsistence. I mean, the old dismal economist, you know, had the iron law of wages, which was true for a long time until unions came and until we had some social programs, whether they were good intended or just to avoid unions or socialism, stealing the socialist thunder in Bismarck's terms. But, you know, put in these social protection programs to make sure that people at least get more than basic subsistence. And now, you know, they're not even getting paid by their employer in many industries even the basic amount that they need to subsist. We're paying that as taxpayers. And I think a lot of us would rather, you know, we can cast our, if I remember my microeconomics, we can cast our dollar ballots in the economy, and a lot of us do that already with the employer across the street from the one who's paying crap wages subsidized by the government to an employer who's paying a living wage and offering the same product and the same service. I mean, it's a matter of competitive advantage. The small businesses I cited in Sitka, you know, where two employers, hell, they might pay more if they weren't competing with that other gallery owner who's paying $7.75. I mean, we talk about a race to the bottom nationally. We're in a race to the bottom in this country in the last few years. And one of the few things we can do to address that aspect of it, and besides just, you know, getting out of poverty, EITC is a big part of that. But EITC don't do a damn thing. It only exacerbates that competitive advantage of the low-road employer. And I think and I hope that Alaskans will take the opportunity to make a material improvement in the lives of 48,000 people and their families. Maybe some of them aren't Alaska residents. They're still human beings. They're working in our state. They're contributing to our state. And I'm an old local hire zealot from way back. I mean, I got to say that. But, you know, if we need to bring people in to work in this state, and most of these people are Alaska residents that would be impacted by this increase, then we ought to take the opportunity. I hope we will take the opportunity to do that. And we can talk in a couple of years, and I'm hoping and expecting that. Well, I'll be showing you numbers just like I'm showing you for 2003, 2004, where if your answer to me is, yeah, jobs grew, but they would have grown 0.2% more if we hadn't put in that damn minimum wage increase. Well, again, quantity of jobs up for whatever reason, quality of jobs in terms of pay up, we'll take that deal. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. Former Labor Commissioner Ed Flanagan and UAA economist Kyle Hampton debated Alaska's minimum wage initiative, Ballot Measure 3. The debate was hosted by Alaska Common Ground, and it was recorded July 30th at the Wilda Marston Theater. Former Alaska Common Ground board member Taylor Brelsford served as moderator.
This talk was edited for broadcast, but you can find the full debate and more information on ballot measure 3 on our website at alaskapublic.org. You can also find copies of the PowerPoint presentations referenced by the speakers. Thanks for joining us today. You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org. For KSKA, I'm Beatty Trantina. Thank you for listening.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.